back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. On with the conversation, I have to remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Coming up this Saturday is something called Fades and Fellowship. It's an unscripted, intimate, honest, provocative conversation with a man named Nelson Mauldin, who is the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's barber in Montgomery, Alabama. Joins us here in studio with Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields, Dr. Shields, co-founder and senior director of education innovation for the Cambio Group.
Sir.
Has been on the show many times, but just not often enough recently. We talked about that earlier. And Darius Wilmore, another old friend, creative director for Taharka Brothers. Good to see you too, Darius.
Hey, thanks for having us, Mark.
And welcome, Mr. Nelson Mauldin. Good to have you in the house with us.
And thank you, sir.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Throw us an email to talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. We want to hear from you this hour. So this is, you know, I watched that video that you did. We were talking about before we went on the air that you did at the University of Alabama in 2012, I guess that was.
That's right.
Right. But take us, for our listeners, before we turn to the other two gentlemen here to talk about what's happening on Saturday, take us back to that moment. Is it 1954,
right.
When you first met Dr. Martin Luther King, you were a college student at Alabama State, and you were a barber coming from a family of barbers, and in comes this young preacher.
On Friday morning at 9:30, I was going to a dance that night, and I had to pay for the tuxedo and buy the girl some flowers. I had a 10 o'clock class. I saw this young man drive up in this blue Pontiac. He got out of the car, and I looked at his head. I said, oh, heck, I can knock him out in 15 minutes. He came in the shop, asked him what was his name. He said, Martin Luther King. I said, where are you from? He said, Atlanta, Georgia. I said, what are you doing in town? He said, I'm here to preach my trial sermon at Dexter. I said, oh, that's my church. So as I finished cutting his hair, I gave him the mirror to say he liked his haircut. And he said, pretty good. So that was an insult to me. You know, tell a barber pretty good.
Right.
So he came back 2 weeks later. I was busy. The other barber was vacant, but he waited on me. So I remember that sarcastic statement he made. He said, I said, that must have been a pretty good haircut. He said, you all right. You know? he kept putting me down. I thought I was the hottest thing in Montgomery at the time. But I said, this little man, him put me down like that. So after I cut his hair 7-8 times, you know, most of the customers give you a tip, at least 25 or 50 cents. I know that young joker never give me a tip. So I decided I'd use a little psychology on him. I said, hey, Rev. He said, yes. I said, when you finish preaching a sermon on Sunday, some of the members tell you what a good sermon is, doesn't it make you feel good? He said, yes. I said, when you go to a restaurant, you have a nice meal, and the waitress give you good service, you give her a tip, don't you think that make her feel good? He said, yes. I think he used a little profanity. He said, do you put 10% of your earnings in church? I said, Reb, I'm a student at Alabama State. I cannot afford to put 10% of my money. He said, hell, I'm the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and I can't afford to tip you either.
So we know Dr. King was not a good tipper. Right. He gave good tips, but he was not a good tipper.
Right.
He never did give me a tip out of the whole time I cut his hair for 6 years.
You cut his hair for 6 years. It was a crucial moment in our history.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right?
Right.
You saw a lot then.
Oh, yeah. Well, all of the leadership of the movement was in about a 5 blocks radius of the barbershop. You know, the college there and the college presidents and some of the leaders of the movement kind of started.
So what? Give us a sense. We're all very different. Barbershops have always been, for generations and generations, a huge focal point in the black community. Huge focal point. A place where men gather and talk. So give us your sense of what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was like as a human being, what your interactions with him is man to man. Talk a bit about how you felt about him.
See, that's what the problem. See, I thought I was the hottest thing in town. See, I was 20 years old.
So
I thought that, plus I was cutting hair at the leading barbershop in Montgomery at the time. So, man, I was well-dressed, you know, had pretty clothes and car, and I thought I was hot stuff, but I had no idea at that time that I'd be cutting the most historical person in history. And so, but our relationship got started like that, but it never did change because that's all the sarcasm came in. For an example, you know, he come in the shop, he says, hey, Bob, how you been doing? He asked me one time, how you been enjoying the civil rights bill? Well, I told him, you know, I said, shortly after the civil rights bill passed in '64, I told him shortly after I went out to the test it out to see how integration is going to work. And so we go out to this white restaurant with a cocktail lounge and a restaurant. And so we go to the cocktail lounge and ordered a round of drinks. A little bit later, this was the first time I ever integrated in the facility. So four white boys came in to join the table. And the band said, do we have anyone want to make a request? And so then one of the white boys said, play Dixie. And boy, the band cut loose on Dixie. Mm. And so then so I told them, then they started hollering some bad words. So I told my wife, we better leave. She said, I think so. And we got ready to walk out. The band played Bye Bye Black. But
Lord have
so
mercy.
Reverend King said, you thought that was bad? I said, yeah, that was very insulting to me, you know. He said, if you went to that same place before the 64 Silver Rap Beer passed, that band would probably play Swing a Little Sweet Cherry coming to carry you home.
Is that what he said?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Oh, man.
People I've known who I knew who actually knew Dr. King would say that he had a wicked sense of humor.
Very wicked. And he always liked to win a debate. But the one of the debates he lost in the barbershop was a sociology professor from Hampton Institute.
Well, what was that?
He lost that debate. Reverend King said one of the strongest forces in the human family was morality. He said it'll bring you together in all type of circumstances. And the sociology professor said, I beg your pardon, sir, I think it's economics. He said when the European white man came to this country, some of the first thing they did was build some of the top universities in the New England area to educate himself. He said when the Manny May got the oranges in Florida, when Domino Sugar got the sugar cane in Louisiana, when Standard Oil got the oil in Texas, when Gallo got the grapes in California, when Philomar Sigourney got the tobacco in Virginia, the cotton in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi, said the next thing they built was to build Wall Street to control the capital, and the last thing they built was West Point to defend it. He said, that is the United States of America. Reverend King said, have a good day, sir.
So he did. He was a bad tipper, and he lost one fight. We can give him one fight, right?
And one of the funny things happened, see, when the church called Reverend King for the minister, we was in the meeting, and one lady voted against him becoming pastor. And so the church wanted to go into a full agreement with calling the pastor. They didn't want any dissent among the members. And so one lady said, the lady to vote against said, what's your problem? She said, well, this man is too young. He's still in school. And we need a more of an experienced pastor to take over this church right now because we had enough problem with our previous pastor. Well, then they said, well, this is the best we could do right now. And so they kept on pushing the lady for her to change her vote. She got mad and she walked out. She said, I don't want that young boy preaching to me. And so Reverend King was told what happened in the vote. The 6 years he was there, but he never said anything from the pulpit about the dissenting vote. So when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, the church invited him back for an anniversary sermon. And he brought his Peace Prize with him. He got in the pulpit. Everybody knew the lady who had made that statement. He held his Peace Prize up. He said, I was a little boy then, but I'm a big boy now.
So you can hear Mark. We can hear this. We can listen to this all day.
All day and all night.
And we have been, right? Oh, yeah. Since he got here.
So I'm curious, when you were 20 years old then, right?
20, yeah.
Right? 1954?
I came to Montgomery when I was finished high school in 1952.
I hope the next decade when I get to my 80s, I hope I'm as sharp as you as you are at this moment. But when you lived through the Montgomery bus boycott.
Right.
You lived through that – you lived through Selma. You lived through all of that.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so talk a bit about that part of your life and what you recall from that, what that moment was like.
Well, see, Selma, that was just an accident waiting to happen. See, the governor, George Wallace, sent his highway director down to Selma to stop the marches. It had been announced they were going to march from Selma to Montgomery.
Were you there? Or you?
Yeah, I was in Montgomery at the time. Uh-huh. I didn't march from Selma, but I was in Montgomery.
Right, right, right.
And so they were going to stop him. George Wallace sent him down to stop him. But George Wallace did not anticipate the television. So George Wallace sent him down there, and Charles Beverly got up in the meeting how the march really got started. Charles Beverly, one of Reverend King's assistant, he said that we're going to walk to Montgomery. But that was impossible. Those old women, how he or she would walk back to Montgomery. But he said, made the statement. So anyway, when George Wallace found out about it, he sent his highway director down to stop the march. But George Wallace back in Montgomery watching it on television. See, television was relatively new then. And so what really made the march was the tear gas in the horse. and running over the people.
Right.
So television made it. So when this highway director got back to Montgomery, he was coming back to be praised because he did stop the mob. He thought they going George Wise was going to praise him. George Wise said, "Damn, you the mess us up now," because he was watching on TV. And then the man didn't know what was going on because he didn't know television that picked it up. The same thing happened in Birmingham. See, the march when Reverend Cain went to help Shuttlesworth out in Birmingham, the old people had lost interest in the movement. And Stokely Carmichael started the Black Panther Party in Lowndes County.
County, Alabama.
He went to Birmingham and told Shuttlesworth and Cain, "Let me help you." He said, "Let's put the students in there." But Reverend Cain was violent against putting those high school students in the march. But Stokely Carmichael said, "You don't have no choice." So Stokely Carmichael, he kept 7 or 8 of his students with him, and they go into the classroom in high schools in Birmingham and said, "Comrades, will you come out and join us for this march?" And some of the students got up, and some of the students did not get up. Then he said, "Y'all ain't nothing but a bunch of Uncle Tom, little white folks," and all of them got up and went out. So what made the march so effective was the K-9 dogs and the fire hose. So they didn't see Bull Connor, they didn't anticipate the TV camera. So when the people saw that picture, and was more than 1,000 words, that was signaling about them, because the movie basically started dying down.
Right.
So the same thing happened in Selma, that If they had not had the TV camera, there'd been more horrible things happening to people before that time. But the TV cameras what made it.
So I'm curious, this has been 62 years since you first cut Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's hair.
Right,
right. Mm-hmm. And you've seen a lot in that 62 years.
Oh yeah.
Right. I'm curious how people raise up Dr. King's name all the time, whatever they need, they raise his name up. To justify whatever's going on. So I'm curious what your view is about where we are right now here in the United States of America in those 62 years you've seen since you first cut his hair.
Well, see, what Reverend Cain did, he had the federal government behind him, basically. You know, he had Lyndon Johnson, and he was in the White House. And so what happened is that the thing we got going on, Black Lives Matter, is that the policemen got their fed. And the students are in the Black Lives Matter afraid. So you got two fields going, and how to solve that problem is going to be very difficult. See, Dr. Lawrence Reddick, one of Reverend Cain's top assistants, he said when a person is born into the world, it's an undeniable fact that they're born into an environment. That environment is going to be with you to the rest of your life. So, but what the city needs to do, and Reverend Cain might have done if he was still living, he would go to the mayor and the police department and see, can you train your police not to shoot a man when he's running? See, a picture was much more than 1,000 words when the man shot the man in the back. The picture, that was, you know, never shoot a person running from you, even the little 12-year-old boy that had the cap pistol. The police couldn't tell whether a real gun or not, but when that bear got out of the zoo, they tranquilized. They didn't kill the bear, but they killed the little boy. So if I was a society that down that they can't recognize a little 12-year-old boy in the park, and you got to shoot him and kill him, and they didn't take a bear and tranquilize him. So I think Reverend Cain would have been very disturbed about what he did. But see, what Reverend Cain came along, you can't underestimate the power of that picture that people saw when they beat them people on that bridge. Uh-huh.
So were you a barber your whole life?
Yeah, my father had a barber shop in Pensacola. That's how I was raised up
in Florida.
In Pensacola. Uh-huh. See, my mother left the country back in 32, and I was born in 33, so they left. We moved to Pensacola, and then my daddy worked in another man's barbershop, but later on, he built his own barbershop, and that's where we was trained up.
And you were a barber your whole life?
Your whole life. So when I finished high school, I didn't have any money, but I had a job in Montgomery, Alabama, which was a block from Alabama State, so I could go to school. I had 8 o'clock class in the morning. I go to the class, might get out at 9, I come back to the barbershop and cut a few heads, might have another class at 11, I go back to class and come back by 12 or 1. That's why I did it.
There was one story I heard that you told that I thought was really funny. When a minister and also Dr. King told people not to go in the back and buy food from the white restaurant.
See, before Reverend Cain came to Montgomery, Vernon John was the pastor at Dexter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he had a temper, so the church had to get rid of him. And so Vernon John used to preach about the white man ought to keep you black folks down. You work in the field from sunrise to sunset plowing a mule for nothing. Now you can't walk the town in dignity. So he ought to keep you down. So then he said, you go to these white restaurants and go to the back door and asking for food. Say you got enough thing to eat to take care of your needs in your own race. He said, first place, black folks eat too much in the damn way. And then he said that He said, then when Reverend King came, he kind of picked up the same thing. He said, you should not dehumanize yourself by going to the back doors. He said, if you cooperate with injustice, it's going to incorporate you. Mm-hmm. So stop going to the back doors. So that Friday night, when we finished working, my boss man then said, hey, Nelson said, let's go down Fairview and get some of that fried chicken. I said, that sounds like a winner. So he goes over on Fairview, and you go to the side door, you knock on the door, you pay for it, and you stand on the sidewalk until they get ready. And so that particular Friday, I looked up the street, and I saw this blue Pontiac. I said, hey, Warren, I said, that look like Rum King car. He said, sure is. So I ran and jumped in the car. I said, come on, boss man. And by the time he got ready to come to get in the car, the lady said, your chicken is ready. So he had to make up his mind. A split second was going back and get the chicken, or was it going to be embarrassed? So he went back and got the chicken. And by that time, Reverend King, his car was a stop sign on the corner. So Reverend King had stopped, had on his hat. He bowed to him. I could see him. You know, and my boss man had them two chicken boxes, and then he bowed to Reverend King. And so I said myself, I sure hope Reverend King don't come back in that barbershop and say anything before the customers what he saw us do. And sure enough, the next Saturday night, he came in the shop. We had 10 customers on the bench, 3 in the chair, 4 standing. I said, damn. I said, there he come. And so he came in. He shook in with all the customers. You know, everybody knew him. And so when he got in the chair, he whispered to me. He says, how was the chicken? And then I said, how you know that was chicken? He said, some of my members gave me some one time and sure was good. I said, you better stop eating no white folk food. It's going to make you sick. He said, I said, you pretty healthy.
So, I love that story. So before we turn back to Mr. Malden, I'm curious what you all plan and how yeah. – how,
man, I can listen to you guys, you and Mark, you know, you and Mr. Nelson. Man, this vision came to me, man, I want to say years ago, man, just to make it real short and plain. You know Lenny the Barber, famous barber in Baltimore.
Good friend of mine.
And Eddie Brown.
Is he coming Saturday?
He's not coming. But Eddie Brown walked into his barbershop in 2006 or 7.
Yeah.
And he asked, you know, he could have gone, Eddie Brown, for those who don't know, philanthropist, gives a lot of money. He could have asked any person in the city, the mayor, the governor, what should he do with his resources? And Lenny Clay said, if I were you, I would invest in young people. And so Eddie Brown gave, I want to say, $5.5 million to two programs. At the time, Urban Leadership Institute, with David and I and our organization, we were one of the recipients
right.
of it. And so I always remind myself, if this wealthy guy, you know, Mr. Brown, can go in and talk to his barber and ask for advice, and I thought about all the barbers that I've worked with, you know, that I've visited in the past and sitting in the barber shop, and I think about all the things that I've learned, the lessons, and I thought about you doing Stoop Stories, and I thought about me doing TED Talks, and I noticed that there aren't a lot of people of color doing those talks. And, you know, being a person of African descent, we are griots, we're storytellers. And I said, wouldn't it be just dope just to bring in 12 barbers with 12 different backgrounds to share 12 different stories? Homophobia, racial relations, police brutality, all of these barbers are going to share a very unique story. I said, man, but we got to have somebody to kick it off at the end. And we call him the man behind the king. And so, you know, Nelson is going to sort of close out. And so we're really excited that he's here. This is going to be a great day in Baltimore. You know, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, this is the year of the black male. And so when I thought who could work with me on this, you know, got my art director to the left of me, who's
Darius
an artist,
Wilmore.
Who's a social justice advocate. You know, we met
one
Nelson years
people.
Ago. And so I couldn't think of anybody else to do this piece with. And so we decided we wanted to bring this to Baltimore, and this is going to become a national tour. But just being around the barbers, I mean, Nelson is funny, but when he meets these other 12 barbers who age range from like 24 to like 50, they just have very different stories, Mark. And I'm not directing this. Larkus, who you know, Larkus and Mark,
oh, yeah.
Lavoe, they're co-directing it because the barbers did have to audition. They had to audition. For this, they had to talk about what they were going to talk about because barbers would go off on a tangent. And my role is to help them shape the story. But it's going to be amazing. And Darius has a surprise that, you know, we could talk about soon that's connected to Nelson. But we're really excited about the Faith and Fellowship. It's going to be an amazing, amazing day for not only just for Baltimore, but for the young people that are coming. And then, you know, I've been doing so much history reading. I mean, reading about what barbers had to go to. You had to decide if you wanted to cut black hair or white hair.
Yeah,
you couldn't
right.
do both of them.
No, yeah.
Just amazing the stuff that I'm learning from these historians around black barbers.
So if we have to break in like 7 minutes. So I'm gonna, Darius, you want to jump in and say something before we turn back to Mr. Malden?
Well, sure. Like Lamar said, we've been working on this since maybe January or
yeah.
something like that. Lamar called me up. Well, actually, I don't know if it was in a car or not, but he had mentioned this whole barbershop idea. And of course, I, you know, yeah. yeah, that's hot. I mean, you know. But then he called me up and said, you know, hey, man, you know, I got it. You know, so he told me a little bit more about what he thought it was going to shape up to be, no pun intended. And then he was like, you know, let me ask you, do you think your man will want to be down? And I was like, who? He's like, you know, Nelson. You know, and I was like, you know, I'm sure Nelson would probably want to do it. I don't see why he wouldn't want to. He was like, man, you think? I'm like, yeah, I think we will. He was like, well, can you call him? And I was like, yeah, I'll call him right now. You know, and then I was like, well, you know, if I'm calling this guy to be down with this, you know, I'm all in. I'm you know, because I know what this is going to turn into. So long story short, we gave him a call, and he said yes automatically. But what I wanted to share with you is also Haiti plays a role in how we met Nelson. You know, so as you know, we did some work in Haiti agriculture a couple of years ago, Big Payback. And Nelson is a friend of Ann and Stephanie Reynolds, and they're a customer of his. So they turned Nelson on to us, and that's what's come out of this all those years later. You know,
are you still cutting hair?
Oh, I retired
a few months ago.
Yeah, just a few months ago.
A few months ago.
Yeah.
Two months ago?
Yeah, and so the Harkin brothers doing the ice cream and his flavor and his arm.
Oh, yeah. About the 19th. Yeah.
Ice cream after my ice cream.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to get my hair cut at Lenny's shop.
Yeah, Lenny, that's a whole, you know, Lenny, man. We wanted Lenny, but, you know, Lenny, it was a whole bunch jumping off. So Lenny, we would have loved him to be a part of this because we think he and Nelson would have had a lot to share.
It would have been great.
But the other 12 barbers are amazing, man. And we're grateful for Larkins, Black Professional Men, and one of our partners as well. So we got a nice team of people.
So before we have to roll out of here, let's go back to another story about you and Dr. King. And I there was kind of a very moving story I know that you told. About when King was taken from us, when he was assassinated. All of us who were alive didn't remember where we were. I know where I was at that very moment, but you were in the barber's chair.
Well, Reverend King left Montgomery in 1960. He moved back to Atlanta. And whenever time he would come back to Montgomery for different occasions, which he came back on pretty regular occasion, he would always live with one of his fraternity friends, him and his wife, named Richmond Smiley. And when he was assassinated, the telephone rang, and Richmond was in my chair. And the telephone says, is Richmond there? I said, he's in the chair. He said, tell him Reverend King been killed. Mm. And he fell out. He leaned over, and I grabbed him. And that was my experience when he was assassinated.
What about you, though, at that moment?
Oh, it was very touching, you know. One man had predicted his death. One of the football coaches had a little conversation in the shop with Reverend King. He told him, said, you know, when you're going against Lyndon Johnson, foreign policies, he said, that's a dangerous move. He said, most of your success has been, you know, dealing with the church and morality. He said, you know, we got a civil right bill and a voting right bill under Lyndon Johnson. He said, I don't know why you're going against his policy. So Reverend King said, my concern is not to American foreign policy, but human life. Mm-hmm. Then the coach got kind of teed off with him because a lot of people was in the barbershop. He said, you know what, Rev? He said, that's going to get you killed. And sure enough, a few months later, he was killed. But he told him that.
Mark, real quick. But Nelson, you told me you'd seen him 2 weeks prior.
Well, he came by the shop when he was in favor. This was a conspiracy theory. We had no proof. The first time it happened, when he came in the shop, we saw two white men parked across the street from the barbershop.
Which is not common
because it was in a black community. Very seldom you see a white man park in front of the shop. And so a few months later, he came back by the barbershop. On this time, we saw two white men on this side of the street parked in front of the barbershop. So my brother said, dog, said, what's going on? You know, we can see the little antennas on the car. That was a full cell phone. And so he came by that. Last time he came by, we didn't see the little white boys in front of the shop. But I went to the door, looked up the street to see that. I didn't see nothing look white in the car, you know, like we thought.
Right.
So we assumed it was security. And so the last word I heard him say, it was that time of year when he came by the shop, we had no air conditioning on, nor the heat. We had the front door open. So my brother and Reverend Cain were sitting in front of the barber. We had a little stoop in front of the barber shop. They were sitting in the window. And so my brother just, out of the clear blue sky, without any evidence, asked him, where was your security now? And that's when he said, the man upstairs is with me now. The last word I heard him say was now. He said, the man upstairs is with me. And that's the last time we saw him.
It's very similar to the words he said just before he died.
Yeah.
And what he'd seen.
Yeah.
So this is for me. I was, as soon as they said, you know, I was going to be somewhere else today, and I said, no. When I heard you were coming, I had to make sure I was in the studio. I cared less about talking about what Trump said last night. I was more interested in having you in the studio and talking about what you were talking about. And I think that to me it's also critically important what you all are doing here, because it really, we had this conversation on the show the other day, that it's really important for our young people to hear our elders and connect and make these connections for our stories and to have continuity and to learn. So this is, I think, what you all are putting together here is critically important.
Thank you.
Really critically important. And,
well, we had him in the street last night.
Yeah.
Where?
We introduced him to some young people walking down the street, some random kids, and we sat down
where
and talked
that?
To them. We were right down on, like, I want to say Charles Street, Calvert Street.
Yes.
You know, we played some trivia with him. Did they know who he was and his age? And it was just an honor to be there. You know, this is amazing. I'm excited, you know, about this whole piece, Mark. And thank you for allowing
us. Oh, I'm glad you all are here. Yeah. So, folks, join everybody tomorrow. This national tour of the theatrical performance, Fades and Fellowship, making its first stop in Baltimore July 23rd, this Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, 800 East Pratt Street. Just come on down and show up. The place is decked out like a barbershop. It's going to be an incredible event. I want to thank my good friends, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields, co-founder and senior director of education and innovation for the Cambio Group, Darius Wilmore, creative director for DeArca Brothers, and most especially Nelson Maldon, who was the Reverend Dr. Martin King Jr.'s barber, and joins America to tell his stories about our world. And it's an honor to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for coming by.
And thank you for having me.
We take a short break.
Thanks
and come back.
Us, Mark.
The young women are bringing their stories to airwaves again. It's time for the Rise of Charm City. Stay with us.